Good afternoon. It is Thursday, May 16th, 2019, and this is Ozarks at Large. This is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. Ahead this hour, Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin sits down for this week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report to discuss government streamlining approved by the state legislature this spring. In just under an hour on NPR's Here and Now, Lori Metcalf is up for a Tony Award for her alternate reality portrayal of Hillary Clinton alongside John Lithgow's Bill Clinton. It's in the new play, Hillary and Clinton. She'll talk about it on Here and Now, beginning at 1 on 91.3. The NCAA softball tournament is scheduled to begin in a few hours for the Arkansas Razorbacks. Arkansas faces Tulsa at 5 in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Oklahoma State is the host for the regional that also includes Brigham Young University. The team emerging from this double elimination regional moves on to next weekend's super regional. This weekend, veterans will perform an original play about their unique and shared experiences. The VA Play a Part performance is the final project of a multi-year partnership between the Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks and the Artist Laboratory Theater. Earlier this week, playwright apprentice Candace Cox and multidisciplinary theater maker Simone Cottrell came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Simone began the conversation by explaining the partnership that began in the spring of 2017.
They did this listening party where they gauged interest from veterans in the area and recognized that as part of the holistic healing that a veteran could experience could be through theater. So for the first year, I came in and we did quite a few different programs just to see what the adult learning process would be with the specific population. So I did quite a few creative writing workshops with the 1A mental health ward, and also got to spend time with the staff and nurses to kind of see like what was going on before I came in versus after I came in. And there was like a complete just cultural change throughout the day. So even something as small as me asking the veterans there, what name do you prefer to be called, and giving them a name tag, reminded everyone of their humanity in a way. So I learned quite a bit, but what I learned the most was we couldn't just jump into theater. It was going to be hard. And honestly, doing the emotional activities caused some worry with the nurses. It got too real at some point. So then what I did was I started introducing visual art as a way to discuss. And so from the visual art, then we could do ekphrastic writing from it and then go into some theater exercises. So the more that became more present, the more comfortable everyone became. And I started seeing numbers rise and I was like, okay, this system is working. So then we also had some workshops at the VAPRRC that included creative writing again and a mask and poetry workshop and then some acting workshops. So again, just testing these things out. And what eventually kind of came out of this was myself and Amanda Sobel Driver, who was working at Crystal Bridges at the time, and Caroline Dotson, who works at VAPRRC, were like, let's combine these three areas together and see what happens. So we combined taking veterans to Crystal Bridges plus ekphrastic writing from those experiences, and then created really fabulous poems out of it that we're now using as part of the script. And that little branch of a program ended up, we ended up winning 1 out of 10 Plaintree Global Person-Centered Healthcare Initiative Innovative Prizes, which was really great, and put this program on the map on an international sense. So everything that we have kind of gotten from veterans who were willing to participate and provide their gifts for us, we now could have moved into where we're at right now in 2019, which was developing the script with a brand new batch of veterans and creating scenes out of the poems that were done, or looking into the some exercises that have been done in the past that we knew worked, which helped create the script, which is how I brought Candace Cox in, who is a veteran, and I'll pass it on to you about your experience with the writing.
Yes, I just got started. I found you on the South Fayetteville Facebook page. Yeah. Kind of a fluke. But I am a veteran on prior Navy, and I have a degree in English, and I've always wanted to write. So I am. This is dovetailed to me. I guess I should just say all parts inclusive, right?
Yeah.
It's dovetailed for me in that I am a veteran. I was actually at a very challenging point in my life when this started, so I've worked through the therapy side of it as well as the writing side all together. I've been right in the middle of that, and it's been phenomenal for me. It's like a doorway to walk through to get to the next point in life. So, but the writing has been wonderful to get to take the stories from the other veterans and try to put them forward in a way that they can share their stories, and we can also communicate to the, you know, to the public who we are, because I think a lot of times veterans get lost in the crowd. You know, we're recognizable in uniform. We're not recognizable outside of uniform. So
through this writing process, what kind of play have you created? Are there short vignettes, or what can people expect?
Oh, gosh. Simone may have some input on that too, but I would say it's a compilation of veteran stories that have come together to kind of create an overall, vision of what a veteran is, both as their regular daily life and who they are as the past that they've brought forward with them.
Yeah, and one of the things that I want to talk about Candace about, and I did blast it on the South Fayetteville Facebook page, was that it's really different when you have a woman writing these scenes, especially a woman veteran writing these scenes, because when we were doing the table reads, I think I looked at you at one point after a table read and said, do you recognize how woman strong this is?
Yes.
And how, like, women veterans don't really get to have that voice a lot of the times? And how, like, when we talk about veterans, you say in and out of, theater term, in and out of uniform form, we also sometimes forget that women are veterans.
Well, yes, very much. I've actually gone to dinner on, any of the veteran holidays, and veterans eat free, and they've looked at my husband before and said thanked him for service, and I'm like, no, actually, it's me, but thank you. I've encountered that a lot. But I think the greatness about this being with the woman's voice in there, too, is proving just how, there's a normalcy of being female. We have a female voice to say, but a lot of times people call it the female voice. Well, we're a soldier, a sailor, a Marine first, and female second. And when I'm writing this, when I'm working on it, and I know when the stories are being told, because we had a lot of female vets that gave us stories too, mm-hmm. I didn't hear, this is a woman telling me her story. This is a veteran telling me their story who happens to be a woman. And that was really something I want to put forward. I hope people see, is the normalcy of a female in that environment. They're not really any different than a male in that environment. They're doing what they know to do, the best thing they know to do. And that is the entire impetus to get them to go and be where they are doing what they're doing. Now you have nuances that, come out of that because they are female or because they are male. Actually, you have a lot of nuances that I think need to be spoken to in the future going forward for all the different gender equality issues of those kind. They're going to have a whole nother story to tell. And it's a much longer story than people realize. That story has, I've been out for 20 years, and I had friends when I was in that were on all sides of the gender issues and had to do, I'm a don't ask, don't tell generation person. So, there's so many stories to be told, and they really need to be told. People need to see the whole picture of what a veteran is, because at the core of it, they're just a citizen of their country that really put everything out there.
Did you take a story that perhaps a female veteran told you and assign it to a female actor, or did you just assign to everybody?
We just assigned it to everybody. In fact, Simone tweaked one of mine that was a very funny scene, and I thought it was hilarious, and then she tweaked the genders on it, and it's a riot now. It's even better. It's just over the moon great, yeah.
What are some of the aspects of a veteran's life that you'll be exploring in the performance? Maybe something that average citizens don't know?
A veteran's life is not all about war. There's more of their life they've spent dealing with regular life than they've spent dealing with war for the most average veteran. There are all kinds of veterans. There's a veteran that got out with all honors, and it was the greatest thing in their life. There's the veteran that got out disillusioned, and maybe even with some chastisement on them, and they've had to find their way in a different way, and they've dealt with anger issues that are different. Veterans are just people, and I know I kind of hit on that before, but it really is kind of the point. It's being a veteran is a part of your life. It's a compartment of your life. There's all the rest of this other stuff. And, I don't know, trying to think about what I really would want to get through to them is just, well, some of the things that I do look at are, it's funny, acting. I think this is a great program to work with veterans because veterans are, in a way, actors. We are taken into a boot camp, which is an acting camp. We are strictly told how to act, how to look, how to be. I've had a lot of people that ask me, friends, because I was kind of a wild child when I was younger, and I had a lot of friends say, how did you do that? You know, I can't believe you stood there and had somebody yelling and screaming in your face. I said, you've got it wrong. The trick is not to sit and take it. The trick is to sit and show no emotion and think whatever you're going to think anyways and continue forward. It actually strengthens your mental character, not weakens it. It doesn't make you conform. It makes you define. And I think actors do a lot of that, which I did not realize until this program, how much actors do that.
Yeah, and that was something a couple of weeks ago. I had this moment of, okay, think about the first week that you came in. We were all like, what are we doing here? What's going on? And then we created those community norms that every time that we did exercises, acting exercises in the morning, how well they fit into what they have already learned at boot camp.
Yes.
It truly, like the movement exercises, they are pretty hard. And I was like, how do I give them more challenges? Because they already know instinctually how to work as an ensemble without speaking.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, great, I'm being challenged now. What can I bring in to make this a little bit more interesting for them? But it was almost this rewarding feeling that we all had that, yes, you can do it.
Yes,
yeah, you can do this. And the culmination of everyone's hard work and being able to reach back into that tool belt of knowing what they already know as a group, being able to show that to the community this weekend.
Are there any other art lab things coming up in the future?
Yeah, actually. So after this performance, next weekend, I am working with the Marshallese Educational Initiative, and we are doing the very first Buebonato project with Marshallese youth who will be performing their first Buebonato for their community. And Buebonato is it's a traditional oral storytelling technique of the Marshall Islands. So it's a way to preserve their manat, which is their culture. How do they preserve culture with these younger generations? Because Buebonato is supposed to be given from the elder generation to the younger generation, and that's something that they see that they're losing in Springdale. So it's our first attempt to see of how we can preserve their culture in that way.
Thank you so much for your time, and break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Candace Cox and Simone Cottrell speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. The VA Play a Part performance is at 6 Saturday evening and 3 Sunday afternoon at 1030 South College Avenue in Fayetteville. Performances are not suitable for children. A reception with the veteran artists will be held after the show. Tickets are free. However, seating is limited. You can reserve tickets by emailing simone@artlabtheater.com.
Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, featuring locally grown plants, offering a variety of annuals, perennials, herbs, roses, trees, and shrubs selected to perform well in Arkansas's summer heat. More information available at westwoodgardens.com. Additional support provided by the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring young professionals, the Fast 15, and networking events in the latest edition, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions and information available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com. Hilarious and heartwarming, The Legend of Georgia McBride takes the stage at Theater Squared through June 2nd. Filled with music, humor, Elvis impersonators, and drag queens, this new play is a reminder that the path to prosperity and fulfillment may sometimes take an unexpected star turn. Performances run Tuesday through Sunday, 443-5600 or theater2.org for tickets and information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Jeffrey Davis's new collection of poetry, Night Angler, is the 2018 James Laughlin Award winner from the Academy of American Poets. This follows his previous book, Revising the Storm, which won the A. Poulin Jr. Poetry Prize. And he'll be one of the authors at this year's Books in Bloom Literary Festival, Sunday afternoon at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. He lives in Fayetteville and he teaches at the University of Arkansas. This week, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss his new collection, Fatherhood, Life, and he says the fear he's had in the past that he would never be able to write another poem.
When I first started writing poems, I remember every poem I finished writing felt like it very well was my last poem. Like being inside of that act of writing was so clearly distinct from the act of not writing that after every new poem, I had moments of anxiety where, you know, maybe this never happens again. Maybe lightning isn't going to strike. And then another poem would happen. I'd think, oh, thank God, you know, this whatever this line to the poem for me was still returning. And then after a while, I just kind of got comfortable in the way in which I experienced the non-writing part of being an artist. And a part of that came with treating the margin as more porous. I often am working with, you know, early writers at the University of Arkansas. One of the first things I try to challenge them to think about is the margin of the page is being very porous, which is to say, what does it mean to not only ask the page to be the place where you're the most observant, you know, your best thinking, feeling, contemplative self? You know, this is the poem, having this conversation, trying to be present in this moment, walking out and engaging with loved ones or strangers. The way in which you walk through the world needs to be in conversation with the poem. Or what does it mean to ask your voice and your hands to be very intentional when you're making art and then look up and be no different in the world? So I think having that porous relationship to my craft has kind of quieted the fear, or evolved the fear, maybe.
It's probably
more accurate.
So does one feed the other? If you're being intentional in the art with the words in the poem, that helps you be more intentional alive, and vice versa?
That's the prayer.
Yeah.
And also in particular with the work in both books. So the first book is really trying to get underneath the kind of myth of my father, how looming he's been in my life, to reclaim the word father. And then now with the new book, being a father myself and coming into my own, or continuing to come into my own, I need this work to impact how my relationship develops with my son in a very real and scary way.
Do you mind reading a selection from
sure.
Night Angler?
Yeah, I'll read the title poem, which is the first poem I remember writing after Revising the Storm. The Night Angler. A headlamp guides me through October cornfields. Along the slender cross ties of bridges, bulky and waders, I sidestep thick briar, patches of poison ivy, all the way to the river's edge, where I kill the lamp. And soon the moon's blue albedo is enough to enter water, with dreamfish prowling the currents. I begin casting toward the far, cloaked bank, all ear, all fixed on the grim swish of my streamer threshing back and forth, a mad bat parting night air. In time, I will lead my own boy into the precision of this contraction inside the throat, this animal alarum in the dark. When my first cast conjures nothing, no monster trout panicking the line, I slide further into the river's cold, send more barbed asking through deep shadow. I labor long to lure a sudden swallow, the wilderness of hunger pulsing on the other end of these hands.
My favorite part of that poem is going in the water and not getting the bite,
yeah,
and then going further.
Yeah.
I mean, those of us who read poetry that we don't write, we leap at these metaphors that we think you, the author, might have, but that just strikes at so much of what life is. You go for that bite.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm a longtime angler and started fly fishing when I moved to Pennsylvania and became close with my friend James, who the poem is dedicated to. And we'd been fishing for years, and he was sort of my guide and, you know, unendingly enthusiastic, you know, and supportive. And I remember when he first asked me to go, let's go fly fishing at night. He'd been doing it a little bit, and the way, at least in those river systems, so brown, the largest brown trout in the system, they usually feed at night. And so you have the chance to catch the fish of your life, you know, and he's telling, you know, he's been scouting different pools and assuring me that it would be safe, that they wouldn't be deep pools that you could drown in. And all his enthusiasm created this image in my mind of what it was going to be like. And then when we got to the river, I remember being so afraid.
It sounds spooky.
Terrified. I was terrified and then uncomfortable. Like, I was like, why am I so afraid? And to the point where there were moments when we were headed to the river where I almost was going to say, can we go back? I changed my mind. And so it was a really, really intense experience because I was trying to grapple with and wrestle and put to ease, like, my fear. And for a long time, there were drafts I wrote of that poem that the first draft was actually, it was addressed to my friend James. There was a you in the poem. Mm-hmm. And for a while, I was trying to understand, like, what is this fear about? Is this my fear of belonging, of community? Am I trying to claim this togetherness through this dark? Is that what's sort of unsettling me? And, you know, how much of it is mortal fear and how much of it is, you know, is kind of psychology, you know? And I wrote draft after draft with that in mind, trying to push that. And it wasn't until my son shows up in the poem and I realized, no, you want to pass on this thing that you fear and you don't even understand that fear. And it hasn't changed the fact that you want to invite your boy into this. And that's when the poem turned on and for me. But it took months and months of drafts of really trying to push and pressure the poem through form and through psychology.
Yeah. Do you visually see that location when you're writing?
In that poem in particular, it was one of those rare poems of sort of one-to-one. I mean, actually, I guess this book has a lot more of those moments, sort of witnessing my son do things or my partner and son interacting in certain ways and having those moments in the present be catalysts that I can feel. There's something, there's some sort of observation that's happening that I think is becoming a poem. But that place, because it's such a place-based poem, and there was one draft where I was like, maybe it's about this place. Maybe that's why I'm struggling. And so there was one draft where it's like the title of the river that we were going to. And a part of it, too, is trying to get that experience of walking through the dark, both knowing where you're going because you've been there before and then having it be made terribly strange by doing it in a different context, too. Right. And even the metaphors for fatherhood, right? Like, I had practiced this thing in the light, and I was so reliant on the visual to feel, am I doing this accurately? Is this successful? And then having the lights turn off and having to realize how low my literacy was for the other dynamics of angling, which is like timing and feeling. And then, as you said, that sort of fear of, you know, in the dark, all you have is that take of that fish. And you're kind of wondering, like, do I actually want to feel this? You know, do I actually want to feel this, you know, fish of a lifetime? Hit this fly in a way that I'm not even ready for. And so there's moments of, you know, getting the thing you're asking for and having it scare you. And that sounds like a metaphor for fatherhood to me, too.
It also sounds like a metaphor for a career.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
you've had a terrific 12 or 15 months, New Yorker and awards. I'm sure that this is what a poet wants, yeah. Recognition and readership.
Yeah.
And now you have it.
Yeah.
Is that ever unsettling?
Oh, 1,000%.
Okay.
In fact, I a very good mentor now, friend, Julia Spiger-Kasdorf, when my first book was coming out, I remember her pulling me aside and kind of asking me, like, how are you doing as the book was getting ready to come out? And I was like, I'm good, you know, I think I'm fine. And she was like, well, and she kind of invited me to confront or realize how just that, you know, you're putting all this effort and time and study and then when the thing manifests, that sometimes that can be traumatic. And I remember seeing, so I thought it was fine. And then the box of books arrived and my wife came home to me with a full glass of whiskey poured. And she was just like, what's wrong? And it's like, all I could do is point at the book. And I remember it took me a long time to settle with that. And, having grown up and moved around so much, like I felt like I already had this ongoing string of people that I'd known and develop some sort of love and care for that then I had to let go by being, you know, displaced so much as a child. And while the contact was gone, the sort of worry and concern and wonder of how they were in the world was very much still a part of me. And what I'd realized I'd just done is just amplify the number of connections I had to the world without being able to then check in and see, like, are you okay? And it wasn't until I had this dream that allowed me kind of let that go, to realize that it's always going to be okay. How silencing that worry and anxiety was it was a big deal when the first book came. This book is more, so Night Angler, I knew I couldn't wait to start this conversation. And there are poems in here that address a son speaker. So my son will be 8 this summer. And there are conversations that I'm starting in this book that, like, I don't know if right now is the right time to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. But I know I can't wait. And so it's a different kind of anxiety about whose hands this book finds. I mean, it's still similar, but because there's such an intimate and clear sense of, like, I wrote this book to put into my son's hands. But then, of course, the anxiety this time was when the book arrived. I realized, like, I didn't know when that was. Like, when do I give this book to him? And I woke up from a nap, and he was reading from the book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then he's reading to my wife, and then they saw that I was awake, and they came over, and he started reading to it from me. And I was talking about this the other day. Like, it's been a long time since I had to try not to weep in front of somebody so that they'll keep speaking. And the way in which people will do sometimes sort of take something that you have an impossible time with answering and gracefully kind of leap over that for you. And then he got to a poem in the book that's about a mole that's on his body, and he got really upset. And yeah, and I was like, no, read it. And he read the poem, and he was like, okay, this is a good book. You know? So at least I got that one right. I don't know about all the others. But
yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask anyway about the sense of responsibility when you do write about events with friends, with family.
Yeah.
The sense of responsibility you feel putting that down, because you want to be as honest as possible.
Yeah.
But someone might pick it up and read it and recognize it.
Yeah, and be hurt by it, or disappointed or confused even.
Right.
And I've had those experiences, especially with my mother. And I understand that that's her integrity of, like, revisiting the mistakes that she's made. And I think as a person and as a poet, I owe her for that kind of integrity of considering and reconsidering and, you know, asking and demanding, obsessively and wondering if you return to the past, you know, can you understand how things went down so that you can have perhaps a different present or a different future. So I think because of that sensitivity, she's the person that I've, in my experience, has responded intensely in ways that I wasn't expecting. But I think I've come to appreciate and understand, and you know, that's the obligation that I want to be aware of. So I don't shy away from those. But so to add to that, so my son, we were at the Arkansas Literary Festival a couple weeks ago, and he was in the audience, and he raised his hand towards the end of the Q&A. It was funny. He was like, this is for Jeffrey Davis. And he asked, like, why do you write about your life? Why do you tell people about us? And I had to take probably a good 15 seconds just to process. And I was with Jericho Brown, and he was next, and I was like, no, I'm good. I'm here. I'm just, this is the moment that I've been begging for, in a way, by writing this book. And my answer to him was, you know, because I'm afraid about, you know, the history that I've been inherited, that the sort of legacy that I've inherited, and how much of that I'll pass on to you without wanting to. So I'm trying to start a story that I invite you to, you know, challenge, confirm, push back. Like, I'm trying to get it right, and I need your help. And this is my best method of hearing the things that are in my voice that I don't want there. This is my best way of testing how much of, as there's a line in the poem, like, how much of the badness of my father have I exercised from my voice so that I can start a story with you that is wholly other from this other one.
Jeffrey Davis's latest book is Night Angler. He teaches at the University of Arkansas and lives in Fayetteville. He'll be at the Books in Bloom Literary Festival Sunday at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. You can learn more about the festival at booksinbloom.org.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Caring for a loved one at the end of life is most difficult, but with the help of Circle of Life, families don't have to face it alone. Circle of Life Hospice has been offering compassionate care for patients and families for over 25 years. They provide end-of-life care from a professional hospice team with little to no out-of-pocket expense. Help is available at 1-800-495-5511 or on the web at nwacircleoflife.org. KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2019 Rocklahoma Music Festival, held Memorial Day weekend, May 25th through the 27th in Pryor, Oklahoma. Over 60 acts will perform, including Disturbed, Bush, Jackal, and Ace Frehley. Winners will be announced Friday, May 17th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Information and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. The sisters at St. Scholastica Monastery in Fort Smith are downsizing. They're holding a live auction today through Saturday. More than 5,000 items up for grabs, ranging from a pistol from the Spanish-American War to antique china sets to commercial laundry machines. The sisters arrived in the River Valley in 1878 in response to the need for churches and schools for German immigrants working on the railroad. In 1925, the sisters moved to Fort Smith and established the St. Scholastica Monastery that exists today. In the 1960s, the community had nearly 400 sisters. Now, that number is down to about 30. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Sister Kimberly Prohaska about the future of the monastery and convent. Sister Kimberly says there have been changes since those earliest days of the monastery.
Probably going from hospitals and teaching and then just eventually segueing into more pastoral ministries and other needs of society. So, again, depending on what the need was, the sisters tried to meet those needs. Primarily, you know, back in the day, if, you know, a young lady coming out of school would get married or become a secretary or an educator or a sister, and then she would have more opportunities for different types of career paths. But since then, after, you know, in the 50s and 60s, there was much more opportunities for women. So those things changed, different roles changed for women, and women had a little more voice in what kind of careers they could choose. So we began retreat ministries. They began working in parishes and education, not only, you know, for schools, but for the people of the areas, you know, in regard to faith and other needs.
You and the other sisters moved out of the monastery in February and have moved into a new modern facility. What has that been like?
A lot of our sisters pretty much grew up in this monastery, and I'm sure it was very difficult, more difficult even for them. I've only been in the community 30 years, just shy of 30 years. And so, you know, the transition, you know, is impactful, but I'm sure it's more so for them. And it's a decision that has not come lightly to the sisters. A lot of what we do is through prayer, foresight, and through conversations and talking with people in particular roles that would assist us to make as an enlightened decision as possible. We have advisory boards that we refer to and people, you know, out in the community that we, you know, collaborate with. So, but in general, most monastic communities are dealing with big foundations or areas, you know, having had schools and what have you. And as the community ages in place, and as fewer women are called or answering the call, I think more women are called, but fewer answering the call in the way that that most communities were accustomed to back in the day. So, so there's been that transition. So, so as we look at that reality, we try to be good stewards, trying to be responsible with what we've been entrusted with. and being true to our call as Benedictine women. So it's been a long conversation, lots of conversations with a lot of advice through our federation, through, again, people that we collaborate with on our boards and what have you. And it was just about being frugal and trying to be smart so that the sisters who are older could be cared for well. And then those who are coming to us would also have less of a burden on them so that they could continue to minister and be called to monastic life. And continue our way of life as we know it to be.
What are the plans for the original monastery if you've moved out and you're auctioning off all these items?
Right now, we've been talking about it, and we've kind of come to a collective decision, but at this point, we're not able to come out with anything publicly. So we just ask for your prayers as we continue to grapple with, you know, what will happen to the older facility and what we're going to do with that.
Given the decline in how many women are choosing the monastic life, how do you keep your mission alive? How do you keep going as a convent when not as many women are joining?
I think it's the essence of who we are, and it's about more about the call and the purpose of who we are as Benedictine women. I think monasticism is very much needed today, just as it was over 1,500 years ago. It's a particular lifestyle. It's like, you know, those who feel a call to be married. You know, people get married, people who live single life, people who are called to religious orders or to priesthood or diaconate or some other calling within a calling. It's a life path. And I'm not sure not a lot of people know that this type of lifestyle is an option for people today. Young people have so many more options. Families are smaller. You know, when you think about even just the demographics of society and how that shifted. So the things that we do today, the things that you could do even career-wise, you can apply to monastic life. So, for example, we have sisters that are musicians and authors, and, you know, you can pretty much do, you know, all kinds of things and still be a Benedictine woman or a monk, a Benedictine brother at the Abbey, for example. You know, so how those tasks or ministries shift and change, it's all fluid. You know, we're not still running and operating, you know, 5 hospitals or running schools, but we're still here. We're a vibrant part of the community. We pray for the community. We contribute as we can with each of the gifts and talents of each of our members. And we are becoming more diverse culturally, and we hope to become even more diverse generationally speaking. We have hope, and we believe in our way of life, and it is a life choice. And so I just think the awareness that people might not realize that this is a viable way of life that people can choose to live. You know, it's a way of life that's over 1,500 years old, so there must be something to it. You know, the essence is that we're seeking God together, and we're doing it in new and discovering and rediscovering new ways to live that monastic way of life in the modern day.
Sister Kimberly Prohaska of St. Scholastica Monastery speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. The monastery auction is being held by Bordertown Auctions. Registration is required to do that. And to see photos of some of the items available, go to bordertownauctions.com. Proceeds from the auction benefit the sisters and help defray costs of the current monastery and provide health care for the older sisters of the monastery. The first phase of Dean's Trail is officially complete. Springdale City officials gathered near Parsons Stadium yesterday afternoon to celebrate with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. Chris Weiser, chairman of the Trails Committee, says the trail, which is the first lighted trail in the city, connects the Jones Center to Highway 412. He says it's a good eastern corridor to supplement the Razorback Greenway, which travels through the center of town.
Eventually, at 412, there will be a tunnel under 412, so we won't have to deal with traffic lights and traffic issues. And then once it comes out the other side of 412, Dean's Trail will go all the way to Lake Fayetteville. The new bridge on 265, it'll go under there and connect into Lake Fayetteville Trail. So we've got big plans, and hopefully a lot of good stuff in the future.
First phase of the project is about 2.5 miles, and it cost around $2 million. Weiser says funding came from the city and the Walton Family Foundation. He says the trail is named for Trail Committee member Dean Legrone.
He's really the reason this trail is here and why it's in this position, because he got out here and he rode areas, he walked. Back here, this is all industrial, and there was no road. He walked back through here to see what would happen. It's City of Springdale property, so there's no easements to be had and things like that.
Weiser says the new trail will provide a safer transportation option to local residents.
It'll give safer routes for all these neighborhoods and children back here to get to the Jones Center, because they come through here now anyway, and they were just doing it haphazard and walking, and you know, and it's kind of scary. But now they've got a lighted trail that will give them safe way to go.
Phases 2 and 3 of the project are being designed, and Weiser says they're hoping to obtain funding that will allow them to start phase 2 early next year. Once construction is complete, the entire trail will be about 5 miles.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Linnaeus Medical, that's the healthcare startup in Fayetteville, is hoping to receive clearance to sell its IV device in South Korea. CEO Vance Clement said the company is working with the Korean Ministry of Food and Drug Safety to get clearance for Safe Break Vascular and to establish a distribution network for the product in Korea. Safe Break Vascular is Linnaeus Medical's first product, and it's expected to help prevent IV lines from failing. The device attaches to an IV line, and when force is applied to the line, the two pieces break away from each other, creating a controlled separation that prevents damage to the IV line. The product is still awaiting clearance from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Linnaeus Medical recently placed fourth in the K Startup Grand Challenge, sponsored by the Korean government. The 6-month competition in Seoul, South Korea, is the largest business accelerator for companies who are exploring the possibility of entering the Korean or Asian markets. The market for IV usage in South Korea, by the way, is twice the size of the market in the U.S. For more details, check out the latest issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. You'll find the digital version online at nwabusinessjournal.com. When we come back, we'll hear from Arkansas Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report on Ozarks at Large.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology, with opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at OneCom.com. That's 1-COMM.com.
Tim Griffin was first elected Lieutenant Governor in 2014 and was re-elected to a second 4-year term in 2018. Part of his responsibilities in that office, of course, are to preside over the Arkansas State Senate when the legislative session convenes every 2 years. The 92nd General Assembly closed out its regular session just a few weeks ago, and Governor Asa Hutchinson termed it, quote, the greatest of all time in terms of Arkansas legislative sessions. Here's Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin with his thoughts on the big accomplishments of the recent legislative session in Little Rock. Let's take a listen.
There are a lot of good things that happened. And I like to really emphasize the corporate and individual tax reductions, really important for competitiveness purposes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough for us to do our personal best as a state. And I think we got a lot of great things going on in the state. So the governor's got a lot to be proud of there. But we've always got to be striving not only toward our personal best, but to beat other states. And so I think the tax code on the corporate side, reduction of the tax on the corporate side and the individual side, I think is really important.
You think that was the most significant thing of this session?
Well, I think transformation is they really all go together, because when transformation, you know, we just had the big first step, which is more, there had been some reorganizing previously the governor had done. This is a lot, this massive 2,000-page bill does a lot of reorganizing. But the end game is not just reorganizing what we have. The end game is having government-wide efficiencies that will save money, that will result in more lower taxes.
Is that going to happen with this reorganization? Because some people would say this was musical chairs, that was things were rearranged into different silos. Is this going to result in financial savings?
Well, the governor has said, I think there'll be some financial savings, but the big financial savings will be as this process continues. You don't transform in a year, in 6 months, whatever. Transformation of a government that has grown for decades and decades, that takes, it's like turning around a battleship. It takes a while. And so this is the first step.
What's the second step?
Well, I think looking at shared services, for example, across agencies. But before I go there, let me just say this. Make no mistake about it. 42 people direct reporting to the governor is too many. Too many.
Yeah.
Whether you're transforming or just reorganizing, too many. You can have disagreements on how you wanted it reorganized, but getting to 15 direct reports makes much more sense.
Yeah.
That's number one. The other thing is, remember, and this is the big question, Roby, Governor Bumpers went from about 60 direct reports down to 13. We just went from 42 to 15. So the question we ought to all be asking, in the 50 years since Governor Bumpers did it, how did we get from 13 back up to 42? I'll tell you how we did. You did not have people at the table over those decades asking, why are we growing this government? Why are we doing it this way? Should we really be doing this? Should we be adding on? Should we be making government more complicated? And if you don't have those people winning the argument, then this is what happens. You go from 13 back to 42. So make no mistake about it. The reorganizing part had to be done. Now to the real, to where the cost savings will come from. Shared services is sort of stop number one, which means there are a lot of services, whether it be payroll, HR, procurement, those sorts of things, where each agency has their own people doing it. A lot of those things should be shared by the agencies, and you pull those out of the individual, not every one of those necessarily, but you look to see which ones. IT.
Do you have any idea how much that would create in terms of savings?
Well, let me just tell you this. There have been massive savings in other states. The beauty of our system, and you know I love our system, the system of federalism we have, the founders were really smart on this. The beauty of our system is we have 50 states, which means we don't have to try, and other states don't have to try everything as if it's never been tried. We can look around the other 50 states and say, you know what, that has worked in that state, that has worked in that state. Let me tell you what I'm doing soon. So one of my transformation heroes, if you will, is former Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana.
Right.
A lot of people want him to run for president. Very effective as a governor.
What are you guys doing together?
So I'm flying up to meet with him. I'm working on getting that pinned down because he's now the president of Purdue. I want to sit in front of him and I'm going to meet with some of his key people that were involved in this. And I'm going to say, Governor, tell me the opportunities. Tell me the challenges. What's your advice to us in Arkansas? Sit down with the person that did the details, the brass tacks, you know, and say, what's some advice for us? And so I'm working on that because a lot of these things have been done in other states. We don't have to start from scratch.
Yeah.
And that is Republican Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin on this week's episode of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock. There is a lot more in that interview, which you can find at talkbusiness.net, including Griffin's response when asked if he'd run for governor in 2022. He is term limited from another term as lieutenant governor. Asa Hutchinson is term limited from another term as governor. And as they say, the political jockeying never has an off-season. So be sure and check that out. All right, in other news, United Federal Credit Union is expanding its footprint in the state. The Michigan-based company says it will open two new branches in Springdale and Rogers later this summer, with plans for additional branches in Fayetteville and Bentonville in the next couple of years. The company right now has two locations in Fort Smith and others in Alma and Van Buren. In Springdale, United already has one branch location. It's inside the Walmart Supercenter along Interstate 49 in Springdale. And that is today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. We'll be back on Sunday morning with another edition right here on Ozarks at Large. Until then, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
Contributors to this Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda and Zuzanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show today. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal with Paul Gatling is part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Gentry. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. More news and information from the region can be heard tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30 Inside Morning Edition with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast. Don't forget you can follow us online at ozarksatlarge.com. Listen to past editions of our shows or individual stories and interviews. And you can subscribe to our absolutely free podcast that's available through services like iTunes, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you'll find podcasts. We'll end today with music from Caleb Ryan Martin and his song Ozark Mountains, recorded for us at the Carver Center for Public Radio. He'll play at the Matt Adams Memorial Event at George's Majestic Lounge on Sunday. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending part of your Thursday with us. We're back tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m.
Still live there. The moonshine's still an old deer trail in the home of a big old bear. And don't step foot in his home, he's better to be left alone. My Uncle Willie lives down the road from that old bear pen. He tells a tale from long ago how that bear ate all his kin. My home is in the Ozark Mountains. My home is in the Ozark Mountains. Home is in the Ozark Mountains, and I can't go back there anymore. Mother, she died last fall, and later her pa went along. I'm picking my heart from the floor, and I can't go back there anymore. My home is in the Ozark Mountains. My home is in the Ozark Mountains. Home is in the Ozark Mountains, and I can't go back there anymore.